Oh, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, whenever you are reaching us to listen to this podcast, Giant Fork and Spoon. Thank you very much for your attention. Today, I have a wonderful guest that I'm a little excited about for Hana Pari. And we've met along our time streams by mutual friends, and I'm so glad to have you on this morning. Please introduce yourself.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the show today. It's awesome to talk about food with you. My name is Farhana Puri. I was born in Pakistan. I lived there for about 5 years, and we moved to Kuwait for about 6 years. And then I went back and, you know, back to Pakistan and grew up there until I was 18. And then we moved to the United States. So I'm here. I've been here for a long time now.
Oh, fabulous, fabulous. The podcast is really about anybody's connection to food, whether it be on a professional level or not. I met you through a mutual friend who's an architect and has done a lot of work with that group of people and doing that in that industry. What is your role in all of that?
Well, I've played quite a few different roles while I've been in the architectural industry. I started off with our friend, and we worked for 7 or 8 years together. And you know, I had family, I had children, and started taking care of them. But while I was in the architectural firm, I mainly did the, you know, the drawings and things like that, and helped with the projects, any sort of small things that needed to be taken care of as well. But our whole office actually became really good friends, and sort of it was like having a small family outside of the house. And since then, I have actually become a teacher. I received a degree in English, so I teach reading comprehension, and I work with the majority of the inner city teenagers, mostly teenagers between the ages of 16 to 20. I work with them, and I kind of play the role of as their counselor sometimes as well, because they don't feel comfortable talking to certain people, so they will just come to me. So I'm sort of their tutor, their teacher, and mentor, so all rolled into one. It's a really, really good feeling.
Yeah, I can totally relate. My job as a chef instructor, I have two classes now. I have a 6th through 8th grade class at one location and a high school class at another. And a lot of them come to me like, oh, it's cooking club. And no. Because along the path, I figured out that they have reading and math deficit, they have attention deficit, and they also have very little nutritional information. They couldn't identify, you know, common words. Like, go get me the shortening. They're like, what? They had no idea what that margarine is not butter and things like that. So I went back to the drawing board and started building that in. And that we don't just cook. We talk about life. And this is, you know, kind of things that touch everybody. Everybody has food issues. Everybody has food memories. You know, something that you have to do every day, but they don't know why they're doing it.
No, the students that I deal with on a daily basis have the same problems. I mean, it really bothers me that they walk into school and they're carrying a can of pop, or they're eating hot chips, and they refuse to eat the school lunch that's provided, which is, you know, it's not that great of a quality, but they still need to. It's still nutritious, though, in comparison to what they can eating. Yeah. So that's like my argument with them, with quite a few of them on a daily basis. It's not really an argument, but, you know, we get to the point of talking about what's nutritious and how it actually helps your body in terms of you working and getting your schoolwork done and understanding and staying awake while you're in the classroom and what foods are the ones that have play a good part in that. So
Absolutely,
that's,
absolutely. What is the primary racial identity to the children that you're teaching right now?
mostly African American and Hispanic.
Okay.
Majority, yeah.
Since our connection has gone, it started with architecture. Do you see a common thread between that study of work and the culinary field?
I do actually, because I, the reason I see the commonalities between the two is because I like to bake and, well, I like to cook, period. But my children, one of them specifically does not like eating cake that's been bought from the store unless it's from specific bakery. That child prefers if I make the cake at home, otherwise will not touch the cake. So every birthday, anything like that, I try to bake the cakes, and I am always trying to incorporate what I learned in the architecture field into what I am sculpting on the board on the kitchen island. So it's, I think it's very similar because there are certain things, and in terms of baking as well as in architecture and science, that you're doing measurements that are so specific in terms of creating the end piece that it has to be able to be stable by the time you're finished. It's the same as you're doing a science experiment. It's the same when you're designing a building. And also, that kind of falls along the lines of, you know, a human body to me is a structure that you need to take care of. Whatever you put in it, that's the one that's going to help it stay strong and keep it up. So my view of architecture and food is most likely very different than, I guess, if you speak to an architect, like, you know, who's actually practicing right now. I look at things completely differently. So to me, I design the building, it depends on the structure that's on the inside of the building, in the walls, what's running through those walls that's keeping it up. And that's the one that's the structure is the one that tells us how long the building is going to last, how long it will stay and standing on its own without us, you know, needing to do any repairs on it. Same thing to me for a human body. So whatever you put into your body, it will show on the rest of it, and in your exterior, in your mental ability to do things, in your organs. It's the same structural way for it to work and last as long as it can.
You brought up something that I didn't think about, the length of a building. That to me, I didn't know that you could calculate that this structure could be a 20-year structure or a 100-year structure. I didn't know that.
It's entirely possible because it also depends on how good material you use. So we see buildings that, you know, brick buildings, they're crumbling and falling down. And you find out, when were they built? Oh, about 20, 25 years ago. Well, the brick wasn't proper that was used in there. You look at the interior, if you go to the basement and the concrete blocks and the masonry that's been used in there, that's crumbling and getting pulled apart. That was bad use of bad material there. But then you find buildings such as, you know, a 120-year-old house that's still standing. You can go to Hyde Park, and there are absolutely beautiful houses down there that have been standing there for how long? But that's the proper material. It's like saying that's the good food. It's eating an apple in the morning in comparison to eating hot Cheetos. So,
Yes,
you know what I
I'm
mean?
so tired of the flaming hot everything. I'm tired of it.
Oh my God, yes.
Okay, cool. I'm finding out more and more when I travel in the architect circle of the world that a lot of architects are really into being a foodie or a culinarian, even if they don't, you know, take that on as a profession. I consider what I do outside of teaching kids, I mostly do pastry, which, like you mentioned, can be very, very precise. It wasn't until I started really doing wedding cakes that I pulled a parallel from architecture, because of having these things not only tier on top of tier, but I have to transport them. So if I don't put the supports in the right way, once I put it in the car, it might not make it to the second location. So
yep.
It's always this little balance of, okay, how do I do this?
Yep. And you also have to, while doing that transporting, you also keep in mind the weather outside, the temperature, and
absolutely.
How are you going to take it? Is it going to, do I have a cooler big enough that it's going to fit in for me to transport it? It's I've been there, I've done that, and yeah, on one event I had quite a bit of an issue because even though I had the cooler and I transported everything, by the time we reached the church and the event was in the bottom, in the basement part of it, and by the time I put everything out, the room was so hot I had to take it back into the cooler because everything, the icing and everything started melting. It was going to become a flood. So, temperature is very, very essential. It's the same way with the buildings and architecture. You know, whatever you're building in California, you have to keep in mind how the temperature fluctuates, whether you're building something in San Francisco in comparison to something closer to the border to, you know, Nevada or anything like that. Those two buildings are going to be slightly different from each other because of the materials, because of the temperature that's changed because of being closer to the ocean or more inland. In comparison to what we built in Chicago, we have to make sure that they can withstand crazy amounts of freezing cold weather.
Mm.
And now we're going to have to start, you know, doing structures that can withstand heat that's above 100 degrees. So, yeah, it's quite a difficult task, and it requires a lot of thinking in both of those, in culinary and in architecture.
Yeah, yeah. When I do events where there's a large cake, or I'm doing cake and catering, which I don't do a whole lot of right now, some people are stymied by the size of my contract. You know, when I deal with a party that's over 300 to 500, you know, sometimes I've done a wedding cake that was $750. The mindset of me is I want it very, very precise. I don't want you to come back and say that's not exactly what I wanted. And then on top of it, there's this big section. I am not responsible for what God does. If you have a hot room, it's not my problem. All kinds of stuff. Yeah, because you never know. And even on the simplest ideas, like I delivered a small cake and matching cupcakes for a reception, and instead of giving me white linen, first of all, there was no linen. I had to request it, so then they ran out to the dollar store, and they brought this tablecloth back with a pattern on it. And I'm like, you're throwing off the entire look of my thing with this funky pattern. And I was just like, okay.
Oh, my God. No, that's another thing. I told you the other day when we were speaking that I work with a catering company as well, myself, and that's something I got interested in because several years back I wanted to start my own catering company, and I started off very small, and it was just me, and I would do events, small events, in-home events, and I was capable of doing that, but then the numbers of those parties, the number of people gradually started going up, and that started becoming difficult, so I had to pull back from it because I couldn't afford to have help with me. So I stopped that, but then I met this woman through another friend who runs a catering company, so I work with them, and actually we have a wedding tonight that I'll be going to. So we've had similar issues and we've had to deal with that. But it that again, connecting it back to architecture in a roundabout way, that once you design a building, you're not actually free of it. You're not just, hey, I designed it, now you have it, ta-ta, enjoy it. Well, the thing is with the so if you're catering and you have the cake and the food and everything, you have to stay with the event. You are responsible for it. Unless, it's a florist who sets up everything and leaves, or the cake is delivered and you're not responsible for it because the baker who brought it and whatever happens, happens. It's they have to leave because they can't be standing next to the cake and saying, okay, I'm going to be responsible for this for the next 3 hours before you cut it up.
Yeah,
But the
that's
caterer has to be there. So it's so we can, decorate and make the cake and everything. And honestly, I've done that too, but I feel so irresponsible. It's like, okay, well, I don't know if I should just tell you it's sitting there. Now it's your responsibility. I also kind of feel like you did pay me for only this amount of time, and I provided the service I needed to.
Yeah.
But with a building, you can't do that. With a building, you are responsible for however long it's standing, however long it's having problems. If it starts having structural problems or anything, then everybody runs back to the architect and the structural engineer. Like, hey, you screwed up. You fucked up my building. What the hell's going on? I paid you enough to do this. And but it's not the same with the food.
Well, yeah. I would say the vast majority of the cakes that I make are probably about at least more than half for pickup instead of delivery. And even those that I deliver, I very seldom get paid to cut the cake. I encourage the clients to do so because they know it's done right. But if they choose not to
Yeah.
make their money, I'm okay. And the minute I wash my hands, it's yours. Out of here before that is
Yeah.
my child.
Exactly. Whatever you do after that is not my responsibility, man.
Oh my gosh. Tell us a
Totally
little bit
understandable.
about growing up in the Middle East and the food culture there, I'm sure, is quite different.
It was interesting because having grown up in the Asian culture, Indian culture, we eat quite some spicy food. It was different being in the Middle East because their food is it's sort of a communal meal anytime that they do a meal. And that's how I learned how they would eat. So, and there are several other cultural differences in there, in that part as well. But the food itself was quite bland to me. It's the first thing I saw was when we moved in, and our landlord invited us to come over for dinner that evening, the day that we had arrived there. And he said, you have small kids, let's just come over here and have dinner. I specifically remember a platter coming out to the in the room where the women were. So it's separated. Men are separate and women are separate. The platter had a roasted chicken, whole roasted chicken in the middle, and then rice all around it in a circle. I did not see any veggies. I did not see any condiments to go with it, sort of like a spicy hot sauce or anything similar to that. And when you started eating, mind you, even though it was bland, but somehow it was done in such a good way that all you tasted was just slight savory flavor from it. So it seems like it might have been some sort of just a little bit of pepper and salt. And the chicken was actually quite moist. And it's funny that I can have this memory even after so many years, maybe because that was the first time I had tasted it. and I was so used to something so totally different. And the rice was quite bland, so it was yellow, and they used saffron to color the rice.
Okay.
And as you know, saffron is quite an expensive
Yes,
item,
actually.
but it gives a nice flavor to it. It gives a nice smell. If you're not a 6-year-old child, you would know. But that was pretty much the way things were done. And they would sauté the vegetables and then steam. Not steam them. Yeah, they would sauté them and then steam them. That's how the landlord's wife would make it. And even then, it just had some olive oil and just a pinch of salt, and that was about it. But if you compare that food to, say, Moroccan food as you go farther west of Kuwait, it becomes a bit more flavorful. Those dishes are kind of similar to what I grew up with. So there's the harissa, that's the pepper sauce that's made. You can make it completely bland or bearable to spicy and delicious, or unbearable in terms of some people's tolerance of spice. And then there's the baba ganoush, which is in Kuwait when I had it was very bland, and honestly, it was. I don't like eggplant, but that thing was fucking horrible. And then you go further west and eat Moroccan food, and their baba ganoush is similar to the eggplant dish my mom used to make when I was growing up. So there's quite a bit of difference, and I think part of the reason why Morocco has a bit spicier or a bit more flavorful food is because there was so much movement between India and Africa that enough Indian subcontinent population moved over there that the foods and everything came with, and therefore it traveled through Africa. So that's why there are so many flavors similar to the ones that I grew up with.
Okay, cool. That's really interesting. I haven't done a lot of culinary work, in that as far as that cuisine goes. I've done a little bit. I know what I enjoy, but if you ask me to make a falafel sandwich, I might be a little messed up until I figured it out. But I'll
No,
order one.
falafel sandwich is not easy to make, I'll tell you that. It's
Yeah.
not. I've tried. No, we should go out more.
Yeah, we should.
Yes.
It ties into a couple of different things that I'm doing, and I really, really appreciate you coming out today and taking this time.
Absolutely.
What you kind of touched on my number one question ask anybody that comes on here is about food memory. And I ask everybody from chef to mom at home, what is your earliest food memory?
Oh boy, my earliest food memory. Let's see. Oh, there is a dessert. It's called laddu. It's LADDU, or it can be spelled LADDOO.
Okay.
It's a circular, little, actually a little yellow ball made out of even smaller little balls. And it's made out of flour, sugar, and lots of grease, ghee actually,
Okay.
and some cardamom flavor. It's a sweet, and you can find it at sweet shops here as well in Chicago, and, well, anywhere in the States now. It's generally available at, or it's presented at like functions and weddings, mostly
Okay.
weddings. I remember actually eating the very first one that my dad's cousin brought because he had just had a first grandchild and it was a boy. And so there's a difference between which sweets you give to people if you have a boy or a girl. So I did not. I remember I had tasted laddu before, but it was nothing to write home about. It's like, okay, it's just a ball of sugar and dough, and it's disgusting, greasy. But man, Uncle brought those. He, I don't know where he got those. He brought a box of two dozen into our house, and I could not, my mother could not pull me away from that box because I sat down there and I freaking started eating those things. I must have eaten four or five, and it was so good. I talk about that to my mom to this day, and she says, I know they were really good, and you kept eating them. And I'm pretty sure I ended up getting myself sick to stomach, but that flavor, that taste, I do not forget. That was my very, very first memory of eating a piece of food. And I'm not a sweets person. I don't eat too much sugary stuff. I like savory, spicy things. But that was the first thing I remember.
Oh, awesome. Awesome.
And
Yeah.
nothing, not none of the other ones, none of the other laddus I've ever bought from anywhere else, they do not compare to that at all.
Nice. Okay, that's really interesting. Well, America is the, swish it around, melt it together, and mix it up kind of place. There's so many ways you can explore other cultures, and you probably know this from living here in Chicago. That was a really big food destination, and neighborhood to neighborhood, restaurant to restaurant, you can kind of dig around and find something for almost every region and every country. I
That's
haven't
true.
quite done the whole circuit yet. I want to do Ethiopian, which I'm really kind of excited about. I'm
You
very
have
into.
had Ethiopian or not?
No, I haven't had it yet. I'm looking
Oh
forward
my
to.
God, we gotta go together.
Yeah.
I love Ethiopian food.
Yeah, I love it, especially if, from just reading about the ingredients and how they're combined in certain ways. I mean, it's really fascinating. It's always been fascinating to me that you can take butter, flour, sugar, walnuts, and complete, make 40 different items with just that. And it depends on how you, what you know, how you know how to put it together, and your own imagination. And
Yeah.
you never stop learning in culinary. Never, never.
I agree. I agree. Yeah, Ethiopian food is quite exciting. In terms of actually learning how to make some of the dishes, yes, it is very eye-opening. And then and flavors are just it's really good.
Yeah. I once worked with a gentleman that was here studying at the university, and he was from Morocco, and really kind of cool, neat, weird guy. I like weird. And he would always sing French love songs, like really old stuff. And he would every now and then make Moroccan meatballs for us, just to have. God, yes. I've tried
Nice.
mine aren't bad, but even watching him, I'm like, wait, yours are so much better. What the heck happened?
Yeah, I mean, he probably grew up making those himself. So, I mean, I'm sure you have dishes that I wouldn't be able to replicate at all, ever. There
Yeah,
just wouldn't be
eating
that taste.
those, I've eaten cumin in like the Hispanic foods, but I had never had them that way, and it really opened up my thinking about that spice because there was a lot of cumin in it, and the meat was tender, but not like super spiced. It was really, really interesting to see how you put it all together.
Yeah, it's everyone has a different way of cooking things. I mean, my sister and I have similar ways because of our mom, but that's how we were taught. But my sister has been able to develop some of the dishes in such an excellent way that I don't like my own version of the same dish. I would rather have the one that my sister made. And it's crazy how different everybody's flavors can be based on your own taste, your own desire for how much each spice needs to be in something. So yeah.
I mean, I've been to places like, you go down to New Orleans, gumbo is, there's 1,000 different ways to make gumbo, and from house to house, I'm sure they're like, nah, yours isn't good as mine, that kind of
Oh
thing.
yeah.
I've seen it with other cultures as well. And like even between me and my mom is an excellent cook, always has been, but there's certain things that we have asked her never to cook again. And just like
I
please,
think we've all
bye.
done that.
Yeah, oh my mom cannot make bread really well. So biscuits, anything like that, we're like, please just buy them. But living through as many years as I've lived through and knowing the different types of people that I've learned to know, certain, like you said, certain things you want somebody else to make it for you. And most of the time that's not really something that sticks in my head, but I remember being pregnant and I really, 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 really wanted a gingerbread cake, which is different than gingerbread cookies. And my mother used to make it.
Oh.
And she would serve it warm with a lemon dressing, and that's all I could think about. I'm like, please, please, I just want it. She was like, you can make it. You can probably make it better than me. That's not the point. I want you to do it.
No, I agree on that. You're saying that you were pregnant and wanted that. I had similar thing happen to me. So when I was expecting my second child, I had asked mom to come over several times to make stuff, but then we were also doing other things, so she couldn't make it. But then I had to ask her. The day I went in to deliver, I told my brother, I called him, I said, "You need to bring mom over because I want her to make lamb and I want her to make yogurt curry. Those are the two things I want her to make. Hers is the best yogurt curry. Nobody else makes it as good. I can make it, but it's not the same thing. I make really, really good lamb chops, and everybody loves them. But it is nothing compared to what my mother makes. Nothing at all. It's so moist and juicy, and they don't just fall apart and make a mess everywhere. Like, all you're left with just bones and the meat is somewhere in the pot. But they stay intact. They taste good. The flavor is perfect. You don't need any extra spices or condiments with it." So that's what I had asked her for. So the day after I gave birth and I came home, they showed up half hour after I came home, and my mom must spend the next 3 hours going between sitting with me to the kitchen to make those two dishes for me because I asked her to come over and make them, and then we froze
Aww.
them.
That's so
Yeah,
sweet.
that's just, yeah. So I completely agree. That's just something that moms can do that, or our siblings, that
Yeah.
nobody else can. So
Yeah, and food
I
is
agree.
like this sensory, the receptor that triggers. I don't know which way it goes. If the memory triggers the craving for the food, or if the craving for the food triggers memory.
I think both.
It's,
I always said both goes both ways.
yeah, and it's so lovely. I know with my oldest, when she was little, like high chair, eating Cheerios, she'd be fine all day. But the minute I put onions and garlic in a pan, she
Oh, yeah.
start hollering, like, feed me now. And I'm like, it's not
Oh
finished.
my God, that's so funny. My older one used to do the same thing. So you would have to hold her in one arm on one hip while you're cooking. So her dad would do that with her, but she was a bit heavy for me to do the same thing with her. And I'm a tiny person. So he would hold her kind of like a football hold, even though he was big enough, but his hand would be right there, and since he had been peeling garlic and stuff, she would just suck on his thumb because there was still garlic on it. And you could hear this kid chomping away on this thumb and just loving it. And she eats good food. Thank God. She likes food and she explores it and she enjoys it. But yeah, no, we explore and we want, and those, I think that's it. Like you said, you put the garlic in the pot, and that smell itself is what triggers the hunger. I don't know what it's in there that just makes you want it right there, because as long as it's got that holy trinity of spices in the pot, you just want food. That's how I feel.
Yeah, and I'm kind of heavy with onion and garlic, but very, it's very much so needed. I don't understand recipes unless they're sweet. I don't understand a recipe that doesn't have onions. It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, no, agreed.
Too
Onions and
bland,
garlic,
not
keep them.
sweet, nothing, you know, no layer of flavor, nothing. So fast forward 19 years, my oldest is off at UIC, trying to earn a nutrition degree, and
That's wonderful.
it's really kind of cool that she took what I could give her culinary wise and is spinning it off into something else. And
Yeah.
it's pretty good. And I think more people need to at least have a basic understanding of nutrition. I think we're churning out all these high school graduates who are only accustomed to eating, you know, manufactured mayonnaise and crunchy curls and Kool-Aid.
Oh,
And
yes.
when you're in high school, you may have like your peak physical condition at that point. You may be skinny as a rail and, you know, playing softball, basketball, and football all year round, but the freshman 15 is coming for you. You off to school or you go off to a job. It's not like, you know, I joined the Marines and the Marines are going to work. No, it's not that. You're going to eventually have to sit down and write the 25-page paper in the middle of the night, and what are you going to eat? You're going to eat leftover pizza.
Yep.
And
Relax for a
because they
cold
don't,
pizza.
yeah, right. Oh my God. And so they don't have a strong basis to keep their body healthy. They just
No.
miss a lot of things. And the older group of kids that I teach at the high school level, there's this sociological thing going on with them in terms of food and longevity. I can stand up there and talk about, you know, if you don't take care of this, and this, you're going to get early, you know, stage 2 diabetes. You're going to get hypertension. You're going to, they're just looking at me like, well, I don't think I'll, and literally have said to me, I don't think I'm going to live past the age of 30, so what difference does it make?
Yes, that's the same mentality that my high schoolers have that I teach as well. It's just, they don't really care about it, and honestly, as a parent, it's bothersome to me that, you know, hey, if I can give this to my kids, and the fact that I grew up with that, I want my kids to learn more about food. I want them to know what's healthy and what's not. I want the same thing with these kids that I'm teaching as well, because to me, they're like my own kids as well. I
Yes.
spend my whole day with them. I want them to be healthy. I want you to be able to make it in life. I want you to live longer than 60. Not be so nonchalant about it. Like, I'm not going to make it past 60. I'm not going to make it past 55 or anything like that. But
Yeah.
I feel the problem comes that you and I grew up with parents when food mattered, when that was like the essential of life. That's what came first. These days, there are so many other problems happening in our lives, and you know, specifically talking about them, this is a whole another thing to be discussing, but specifically talking about inner city youth, they have their lives are complicated, extremely complicated. They have way too many problems occurring inside the house as well as outside the house.
Yes.
So in order to get the parents to even get to the point to speak to their kids about food and about health and make sure that they get that nutrition is quite difficult because there might not be, and most of us necessarily, there aren't enough resources for these parents to actually provide that sort of meal for these kids. So if they can't give it to them, it's difficult for them to actually talk to the kid and tell them, okay, you know, you should be eating this and not that, but guess what? I can't get this for you. So that's, you know, that's a conversation at a whole nother level, and where it can go is crazy. But we grew up with something that I feel like our kids these days are not growing up with, not getting that same education from home, not getting those pointers from home, not getting mom running after you that, you know, you need to do this before you go, you need to eat this before you go. But today, mom and dad both have to work, and we can barely make ends meet. So to me, my 200, close to 200 kids I have at school, my goal is to convince them, okay, you know, you need to get to your math class after your lunch period. You need to eat something. I don't care what you eat off the plate. I used to do this with the elementary kids who will not touch food. But there is, thank God, there is some nutritious piece of food on that plate when they're getting the lunch. There's always fruit, at least that day. So
yeah.
My goal with them is I'll walk through the lunchroom every once in a while, just like our principal does. And I just tell them, okay, eat the piece of fruit and drink the milk or the orange juice that's available. Just eat the piece of the fruit that you're given. I do not care if you eat anything else or not. I understand it's not tasty. And, you know, the whole Jamie Oliver thing where he was going around doing that at schools and changing their meals, I wish somebody from the States actually did that and not somebody from across the pond had to come over here and do that with our kids. My goal is still to actually get to that point so that I can help these kids be able to get tastier food, because I know they're capable of liking and trying new things. But I weird off the subject and ended up somewhere else. Sorry.
No, not at all. Because, you know, I have to tell my kids frequently, the ones I live with and the ones I don't. Currently, I'm like, I have an autoimmune problem. I'm taking 12 pills a day. How about you take
Oh, my goodness.
That? Yeah. I'm like, you know, and I've been known to break out my little pill box. And shit, I have a Morocco full of drugs here to get me through the day. Why would you put yourself in that kind of hurry if you knew what is down the road if you don't make better choices?
Yes.
And the concept for them is so foreign, and I understand that too. You know, I took some psychological training that, you know, talked about the hierarchy of needs, and you can't talk to a person about philosophy if they're hungry, don't have a place to stay, don't feel safe. It just absolutely makes sense. So I don't want to hear all of that. I got to figure out if I'm sleeping on a park bench today. That's my holy goal. Yes. And you go, oh, yeah, makes sense. However, I got to keep pulling and pulling, because once they've crested at that hurdle, then what?
Yes, agreed. It's really, really good.
It's difficult for parents. I don't care what level you're at, who you are, where you're living. It's difficult for parents to give their children anything that they don't completely understand themselves or they don't have themselves. I can't buy a car for you if I can't afford the car I currently have. So the same thing for me in ethics, same things for me in understanding adulthood and how to navigate and how to do things like create and manage a budget. Too many of our people, especially in the African American end of things in this city, don't maintain a budget. So when the kids are about to go off to college or get a job, I can't show you how to balance a checkbook properly because I'm not doing it.
Yep.
Or if I try to keep that in my mind when I'm dealing with them.
Yeah, no, absolutely, yes. You do have to keep that in mind because you are the teacher. You're the one who's giving them that education because you know it's coming up. You know they're going to need that, and they're not getting that from anywhere else.
No.
So our students learn the same thing, budgeting, and then I've had to use that example for them because our largest class of our seniors graduated this year, and Monday I had one who called me and said, you know, hey, Ms. Becker, I got my first job and I'm going there right now. I'm walking over. And I said, that's great. So I congratulated him. I said, well, you know, you tell me when you're finished with your day and, you know, when you come in to pick up your papers, then we'll talk more. So he came in the other day to pick up his diploma and but he called me actually at the end of the day when he finished his job, Monday, the first day. He called, gives me a call at 9 o'clock and says, I'm out of my workplace and I finished my first day of work and guess what? And I said, yes, what? And he said, I made $100. Like, he was so so excited and so happy about it. It felt really, really nice to hear that excitement in his voice. So I had to ask, I said, well, now you know what you have to do with that $100, right? And he said, I don't know right now. I said, well, remember all the budget lessons that you had in your social studies class with the teacher, and keep that in mind. So don't go spending that $100 on a pair of shoes or anything. You need to
Right.
figure out how to start saving it so that you can use it later for something even more important. And you don't need that pair of shoes that you're liking on another kid's feet right now. So just keep
Right.
that in mind. So, I mean, there are, at our school, we're teaching them, and yes, they do need that education to learn how to do budgeting and how to figure out that I can actually eat good food instead of, going and eating hot chips every day.
Yeah, there's a perception, and I'm not really sure. I know it's not accurate, but I'm not really sure where it started. But there's a perception that they think that the junk foods and the pop, the chips or whatever, is cheaper to buy than lettuce, tomatoes, all the produce. So
Yeah.
mom and dad go down the center aisles of the grocery store picking up junk, as opposed to someone like me or you. I can go to a produce market or general grocery store. I can pop $50, $60 worth of fruits and vegetables, easy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
They don't see the example. They don't get the example. Therefore, they don't know that it exists, something like that exists, so that they can get it themselves. So it's difficult.
yeah, I even get I sometimes in class I sound kind of like a conspiracy theorist sometimes, because I have to tell them, you ex as I said, you explain to me why a 2 liter of orange juice is $7, but a 2 liter of Coca-Cola is $1.50, $2. Explain to me, why is that? And they have no clue. I'll ask them things
Yeah.
like, what kind of salad do you like? And they'll tell me, oh, I like a chef salad, I like this, I like a fried chicken. I'm like, that's not salad anymore. And then I'm like, what do you put on it? Ranch. What's ranch? What flavor is that? It's ranch. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go to the grocery store. I'm going to sit back and I'm going to let you in the aisles. Just imagine, you have the entire grocery store. How do you make ranch dressing from scratch? No clue. I say, because
Nobody
you know what?
knows.
I don't even know how to do it because it's not real food.
No.
Yeah,
And
go.
honestly, if you ask one of those kids to read the ingredients on their bag of hot chips, they will start, and they're like, well, I don't know how to go on. And honestly, dude, I don't know how to read that word either. So, does it sound like food? No.
Right.
So, why are
Right.
you eating it?
That's one of the things I do, especially with the younger kids. I try to, the younger kids are 6th through 8th grade, and we did a lot of
Yeah.
work this last term in regards to nutrition labeling, because I think the earlier you kind of understand that, it's a little bit easier to embrace it when you're shopping. And I mean, 6th and 8th graders really don't have a whole lot of input about what is in the kitchen at their house, and I understand that. But you might say, Mom, you know, I don't want the Oreos. Let's get a bag of apples instead. And you may have that push that starts changing small things in your household, in the things that you eat. Or even when,
Agreed.
you know, you get a little allowance maybe and go to the grocery store, instead of buying a bag of chips, how about some carrot sticks? You know? And they're like,
Carrot
oh,
sticks,
not thinking
bananas,
about it.
apples.
Yeah. You
Yeah.
know, oh, too many of us discount or conveniently forget that when we're talking about food intake and calories, they won't mention the snacking that they do. They won't mention the desserts that they've done. No, it's, well, I had this for breakfast, and then I had lunch, and then I had dinner. I'm like, is that all you ate? How many
Yeah.
liters of soda did you drink? Yeah, all of those are calories.
Yeah.
Like, what?
Yeah. The sugar, the calories, it's a mess.
Complicated stuff, but an essential part of living in this type of society. You know, you're not going out in the front yard and getting 80% of your food out of a garden and chasing the chickens that you own and, you know, feathering, you know, defeathering a chicken and fixing things quick and right fresh. No, you're getting it later. You're getting it prepackaged. You're getting sometimes pre-cooked and all. And
yeah,
so why would,
microwave.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Hot pockets.
Microwave the pizza rolls.
Right. I asked one of my students, every day she would come into the lunchroom during, you know, in the afternoon for a snack, and she wouldn't eat the snack that we were handing out. Sometimes I understand because sometimes I look at what was available, and I'm going, the kids aren't really going to like that. But she would always go to the microwave and pop popcorn in the microwave. And so I asked her, I said, well, what do you have? Popcorn. What kind? It's got white cheddar. Have you seen somebody take a cheddar cheese roll and sprinkle it on your popcorn? She's like, no. I'm like, what's that film on the inside of that bag? Butter? Really? Let's go look at my butter, and then you tell me if these two products have anything to do with each other. Oh, come on, chef. You don't want us to eat nothing. I'm like, no, I want you to think about what you're eating and why you're eating it. One of the other things that is like my kind of quote-unquote trick question is I've been asking them frequently, do you eat grits? Most of my kids are African-American. Most of them say yes. Okay.
Yeah.
What is it? What do you mean? I give you a garden. I give you every seed to plant all over the globe. Which do you plant to make grits?
Nobody knows.
Nobody knows. I'm like, so when I've been with them a little while and they've done nutrition models as far as types of food, some of them can tell me it's grain. I'm like, yes, it is. It's a carbohydrate. But how do you grow it? No connection to what it is. I'm like, it's corn. It is? Yeah, it's a corn product. I didn't know that. You know, somebody just put a bowl down, and not only did they put a bowl down and say, here, eat it, you decide to sprinkle sugar on it. So you double it up on your No, stop. Please stop.
Gosh. They just need a little bit more education about food and what's good. And the going back to the same point, what you put inside is what's going to show on the rest of your body.
Absolutely.
What goes in your stomach is what's going to sustain you and keep you lasting longer than 60 years. So.
Yeah. I put up those kind of numbers. I talk about early onset diabetes and hypertension. I'm like, why are you, you know, and sometimes socialization on top of it. We take them out to restaurants on occasion and, you know, do the whole formal kind of thing. You know, I'm like, you're as capable as any other kid to sit there and, you know, have a dining experience, and when you're polite and you use the right fork and, you know, you have general conversations that don't include negative things that people don't want to hear about while they're eating, you're capable of all of those things. However, you don't practice
educate.
It. Yeah. So we're in the struggle together. I promise you. We are definitely in the struggle together. And I don't know how the difference in the generations happened. My grandparents both, you know, we went home to the South on the family farm and all the time, and that was there, and that's where they grew up, and they transmitted information to my mother, who transmitted information to me, and like the first, I want to say 8-9 years when my parents were still married to each other, they were hippies. They were vegetarians. I remember my grandmother sneaking me hamburgers and Fruit Loops. She used to have a box of Fruit Loops just for me. And that was cool, but she had that nervousness, like the baby's not getting enough protein because you're not eating meat. And that's a misnomer, but she's off a farm. So, okay, I can understand where your thinking goes. But having exposure to different things and different ideas and alternative things that you could do and live with, it's always kind of been a part of what I've always known. And I never understood how the generation behind us, the millennials, they have no touch tone to a couple of things. One is traditional foods, real food instead of the American fast food industry. And two, the same kind of idea about ethics and courtesy, that
Yeah.
how did that not get transmitted? I'm still looking for that answer, because I'm sure your parents, like mine, had ways to communicate to you: if you keep embarrassing me in front of my friends, you and me will have a talk in the bathroom. And you, that's the
Oh,
last
yeah.
thing you want to, nope, oh, I'm going to sit down and read a book, because I'm not about to get killed in here. It was just like,
Yeah.
why is that difficult? A lot of my
Well,
kids will cuss out their teacher, and I'm like, really? Like, who accepts that?
and the teacher can't do anything about it, because here's my understanding of how things kind of started falling layaway over there. But it's two reasons: corporate America and money. And once we grew up with our moms and grandmas having to stay home. These days, our moms have to, well, not our moms, but a lot of the moms have to work. You work, I work. I mean, I stayed with my kids at home as long as I could, as long as I could afford to. And then it was time when they got older, and now it's time for me to, it was time for me to get back to work and get in the field again. But I also needed to be at work. And it's, as much as I've been able to teach them myself while I have been home, I have taught them. But you know what? They still have those things like, oh, I want frosted flakes for breakfast. And I don't keep frosted and sugary cereal in my house for that reason, because I know that my kids will not leave that thing alone. They will eat that freaking any hour of the day. I don't keep chips at home because I know they're going to end up eating it. So if you see my kids eating chips at a party, it's like they've never seen the thing. It's that crazy. Seriously, it's that nuts. But our the high school age generation right now, they did not grow up with that kind of stuff that we did. They also have things like, oh, the law says you can't slap me. If you do that, I'm gonna go tell somebody. And talking back to the teachers and saying all sorts of crap to them and calling them names or whatever, they're cursing at them. The teacher can't do anything about that either, because of the laws that have been passed that, okay, teacher can't say anything, teacher can't do this, she can't do, or he can't say this. It's not even a matter of laying a hand on the child. It's a matter of what comes out of your mouth, what words you are saying to the
Corrective
child.
measure.
So these politicians, they've handed the authority, basically, somewhat of an authority, to these children, that here, you run it, you do it the way you want it done. That kind of screwed the kids over. And the corporate America having to want to run McDonald's and Burger King and all that stuff, they don't give a shit about the kids. They don't care about what happens to anybody's health. They gotta make the money. So the more they can put out there in terms of ads and, who all sorts of toys, oh, you get, buy this, this, and this, and this happens. My thing that I started doing after I had kids, and honestly, I ate all sorts of shit when I was growing up too. But once I had kids, it hit me, I don't want them eating all that stuff, because look at my health. I have so many issues right now. So I don't want them going through it. So I got both my kids to sit down one time and do research on the computer and find out what the ingredients were in the McDonald's burger
Oh,
bun, just the bun on its own. And I asked them to actually do the whole thing. The younger one didn't sit so still, but the older one actually got so interested in it, went all of the way back to do research on each of those ingredients, quote unquote ingredients, that were in there to find out what they were made out of, and ended up finding out that the material, there's a substance in there that's used, it's the same as for used for making yoga mats. So yeah, the same thing with the Subway bread as well. And so now
Bread does
my
not
kids,
need high fructose corn syrup.
Yep.
but it's in there because they know that you're addicted to it, or at least will become addicted to it.
Absolutely. So
McDonald's
they
French
are
fries.
so against it.
Right, exactly. McDonald's French fries has 19 ingredients on their
Yeah,
French fries.
what kind of freaking potato needs 19? How does a potato come up with 19 ingredients?
And a lot of them don't
Honestly.
know that part of the ingredients is a beef broth. They're softening the beef broth. It used to be actually a pork broth, but
It used to be pork, yeah.
a lot of people from other cultures complained that they couldn't even eat the French fries here, so they changed it. But
Yeah.
after we do something like a sandwich week, and I let them make French fries from scratch, either in on the oven or in a fry pan. And then I asked them, okay, what did you use to make the French fries? They're like, potato, salt, oil. So okay, now look at this. How many of these ingredients can you even pronounce? They're like, why is that going on? But you do that every time. You mindlessly eat those French fries. The minute you walk out this door, you walk past them and you go get them. Why? It's been so good talking to you. I love the fact. And I applaud you for, taking on a teaching role. We need more people dedicated to that idea, and we need our state and local government in support of properly funding and
Yes.
hiring and, all of these things. Our school system in Chicago is in major jeopardy. If you're listening and, you've kind of kept up with this podcast, or if you're just jumping in new, one of the interviews I did earlier on was with Chef David Blackman, who works at CPS headquarters, who's involved from top to bottom in what they call CTE, which is career technical education. So cosmetology, woodworking, culinary arts, all the things like that that are kind of pipelining kids to schools of that trade or this trade. Because not every kid is gonna, become a philosopher. That's not gonna happen. So we open up all these other opportunities for them. And David was very, very candid about what's going on currently, why certain things aren't working the way it is, what's the propaganda, what he agrees with and what he doesn't agree with in his role at CPS in a very pivotal spot with at headquarters. And if you're interested in education and food, tune into that one. Pull that up out my archives. That was really, really powerful. Oh,
Excellent.
I'm
Thank
so
you for having me.
glad. Yeah, you came on. You were one of the ones I did not expect, necessarily expect to see you. Like, hey, I want to be your next interview. I was like, oh my gosh. So thank you.
Thank you so much. It was really great talking to you. I loved our conversation. It was wonderful. I'd like to talk more about this and discuss and, spread the word
Not
and
a
get
problem.
everybody
We will.
working
More
on this so
than
we can
looking.
work with these kids.
Oh, I'm looking forward to having you back. It was a really good interview, and we will get together and explore Ethiopian cooking.
Oh, awesome. That sounds
All
great.
right. Thanks so much.